Welcome, ladies, gentlemen, fellow slaves of the Global Plantation. The Vinnie Eastwood Show is bad news. It's like the news, but worse. It's the lighter side of genocide. Just because we're being exterminated doesn't mean we can't enjoy it. Otherwise, what's the point of being killed? The Vinnie Eastwood Show. We're the only thing worse than living in a high-tech global police state run by child-trafficking Satanists is Vinny's jokes. And my very special guests joining me today from all around the world, the lovely and enigmatic Ellen Brown from Web of Debt, Simon Thorpe, and Colin Maxwell from here in New Zealand. As well, and Simon's coming at us live from Europe. So it's a truly international effort here tonight on the Vinnie Eastwood Show, this being the last broadcast on the Republic Broadcasting Network, which we've been broadcasting on for most of the year, and I'm incredibly grateful to have been given access to the platform for free, but they've found somebody to pay for the airtime instead, so they've made a financial decision, and I completely accept and support that decision, because at the end of the day, hey man, we all got to pay bills, and if we can't tell the truth and whatnot. But fortunately, I've got another network picking me up right after this week in the exact same time slot at groundzero.radio. So next week, this time, ladies and gentlemen, we'll be on a new network, and I'm very grateful for you to all be following us there. Now, my very special guests, as I've already introduced, the topic for tonight is the public banking final solution. Now, a lot of people may be confused because economists have made a concerted effort over various decades to convolute the language and the ideas of the financial system. This is also a methodology that people who engage in fraud and hustling do. For a very good reason. When you're engaging in a fraud and a hustle, you get people very angry with you. So if they don't understand that they're engaged in a fraud and a hustle, you get to continue doing it without very much public backlash, because people don't even have a language to describe what you're doing to them, because they don't recognize it. They think to themselves, oh, this just doesn't make sense. It does make sense if you're a criminal psychopath. Now, the banking system as we currently know it is a consortium of private and international banking things run by all these families, but it's a side issue. The key point here is, what is the mechanism by which these people create money? And the answer is, out of thin effing air. They're able to create money out of thin air. Now, I'm not sure if anybody knows the coupling of the words bribery and corruption, but without much bribery, there can't really be all that much corruption, can there? And when you've got a certain group of people who have unlimited money, there's no limit to the amount of bribery that they can commit, is there? Therefore, if you look at not just the banking system, but corruption across the entire Western world, be that private contracting, which is twice as expensive as doing in-house, or money disappearing in the trillions the day before 9/11. But anyway, these things can really only be accomplished because of the way the banking system currently works. And if there is this central problem, private banks as being able to create money up out of thin air like a magic trick, and stuff that isn't backed by anything, what is the solution? Is it gold-backed or whatever? No. It's very simple, actually. The same mechanism, and this is a very important principle here, the same principle that is being employed by the banksters to commit scumbaggery can be employed by those who love truth and liberty and freedom. And so what we do here is we come up with this system whereby you can create money up out of thin air, but instead of charging people interest for it and taxing them for it, you can instead allow that money to be paid without interest, That way, you're just creating money, and people are benefiting from it without being enslaved by it, without a profit motive that they have for all of those people who engage in greed and corruption and bribery. And the three specialists that we have here tonight in their own fields are adept. And the discussion that we're trying to have was exactly how we can implement this public banking solution, which it will annex the vast majority of corrupt activities, regardless of their scope and regardless of their direction, worldwide. We do this here, and everything else in the world falls by the wayside in terms of the banksters. Start small at first and grow larger and larger until it takes the country back. That's the idea behind this discussion. Alan Brown, I'd like to welcome you to the show. Opening comments and statements, if you please.
Thanks, Vinny. Yeah, I think you summed it up pretty well. Of course, banks have been, or I should say bankers or financiers have been creating money, let's say going back to the 17th century goldsmiths, who took people's gold for safekeeping and gave them little promissory notes that were, you know, gold certificates. And people wanted to borrow the gold, but they borrowed the gold certificates because it was a lot more convenient to carry around these little pieces of paper than to actually carry around the gold. Our system goes back to, well, it's called fractional reserve banking. So basically the banks only have a certain amount of gold. Originally it was gold. Now it's just reserves, which are something created by the central banks. But originally it was gold, and they figured out that they could lend 10 times as many paper notes as they actually had gold on average, because people only came for their gold about 10% of the time.
All right. So with that being said, we've got now the background of it. So let's go to Simon Thorpe there. Simon, go right ahead, brother.
Just a couple of numbers. The amount of debt, there's a thing called the Global Debt Monitor, which just came out with the latest figures, $307 trillion of debt in the world. This is bringing together everything, governments, businesses, and individuals. $307 trillion. This has actually doubled since the financial crash. How is this possible? This is because banks are just creating more and more debt. Every time the French government runs out of money, they go and say, we need another 10 billion euros, and the money magically appears. They go in to talk to 14 different banks who just produce the money, and they charge interest on it. And so as a taxpayer, I am now liable for nearly 3 trillion euros of debt. And there was a very interesting article in The Economist earlier on this year where they actually calculated the cost of interest payments. Currently, last year it was like $13 trillion US dollars in interest payments. And it's going up because all the interest rates have been climbing in every country. And they anticipate that in a couple of years, it'll be $18 trillion every year of interest payments. That's money that all of us have to find to just feed this sort of enormous tapeworm, which is basically feeding itself from us. There's no need to do this. Because, and as Ellen has very brilliantly written in her book on public banking, you could have essentially public banks doing the money creation process, and then you can pay interest if you like, but it gets fed back into the system. And New Zealand, and in your book, Ellen, it's beautifully demonstrated. New Zealand and Australia and Canada, they had a really wonderful time in the sort of from the 30s through to the, you know, early 70s, where everything worked fine because there were public banks and they all got closed down basically. And so that's the solution. It's to take away from commercial banks the right to create money out of thin air and charge interest on it, because that pile of debt is not going to decrease at all. It's getting worse and worse all the time because the interest is just accumulating. And so that's the public banking solution in a nutshell. It's just governments would never borrow money from a bank because they don't actually have the money they lend you. They'll just say, oh, yeah, they have another 10 billion. And Yeah, that's the nutshell. Why is this very difficult to do? Well, obviously, if you're raking in $13 trillion every year in interest payments, which is what the banking system effectively doing, some of it gets handed on to other people, but you can pay all the politicians, all the journalists, all the economists, and that's why you never hear about this, because basically the media and politicians and economists are controlled by the people who are raking in the interest. That's why it's going to be difficult.
And that's again, one of the main discussion points here is, let's say we've got the solution. We do have the solution. The key is the implementation. All right. I mean, I see lots of people doing their court cases and things of that nature, and they're hoping to win their cases against people that we know don't follow their own rules and make up the laws as they go along and are serving corrupt interests, right? We're bashing our heads against a brick wall. So the public banking solution has to have an implementation solution. And this idea that we were having a discussion with Colin earlier on, a precursor to this broadcast, is about setting up a public bank small scale, or even a private bank small scale, that adopts certain principles like this. And the question is, how does the banking software work? How do you actually physically set up a bank to do this? And could it be done small scale, people voluntarily participating into it, so that when we get into the next election, we may have actually a New Zealand Loyal brand bank that's actually associated with it? Things like this. These are the ideas that we were talking about. Colin, if you'd like to unmute now, I'd like to hear from you on this, because we've just done the New Zealand Loyal campaign and they got about 1% of the party vote, and the 1% public tax was a big issue point for them, and Colin was helped a significant amount with that. But take it away, Colin.
I think Alan summarised it beautifully. She wrote an opinion piece for New York Times back in 2013, and I'll just quote that because I think it just sums up the whole thing. Banking, money and credit are not market goods, but are market infrastructure, just as roads and bridges are physical infrastructure. So in other words, why on earth is banking and money not run as a public utility for the good of all society? None of this is new, as Alan said before. This goes back centuries, and sometimes it's a crisis that actually brings all this out. And there's another quote from William King, the Prime Minister of Canada in 1935. Once a nation parts with the control of its currency and credit, it matters not who makes the nation's laws. Usury, once in control, will wreck any nation. So that was William King, Canada, 1935. So it's just my impression is we've got another huge crisis looming that'll probably make the 1930s crash look like a Sunday school picnic. So I'm sort of thinking that this crisis will hasten some of these solutions greatly in the very near future. The problem with all of our main currencies are fiat currencies that rely on selling government bonds, and that whole bond market now, it's a disaster waiting to happen as far as I'm concerned. What are those main Western currencies based on? Basically the fact that they haven't been able to sell their debt in terms of government bonds, and I just see that coming to an end. So I don't see all this lasting until the presidentials in 2024, to be honest, but that's just my personal opinion. Thanks, Vinny.
No worries. So the element that we need to get into the equation here is, of course, we've got so much corrupt individuals in the way of something like this. I mean, goodness knows what kind of plans and schemes that they have for the derailment of some kind of people engaging in the public sector. So with that, is there experience that we can draw upon in the opposition of public banking that we can really help the new people that are trying to fight this fight to learn from their elders? We'll be right back after the break. You listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Lovely being on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Last time, ladies and gentlemen. We'll see you soon. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the show that's all about keeping your Luftwaffe aloft. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on republicbroadcasting.org for the last time today, ladies and gentlemen. Next week we'll be going shifting over to the Ground Zero Radio Network at groundzero.radio. So thank you so much for those of you to want to continue following the show over there. Now, my very special guests, Colin, Alan and Simon, and talking about the public banking solution. And I want to advise people that anybody who goes into a form of activism against criminal psychopaths should expect resistance when you're trying to bring them to justice. There's a rule, okay? If you want to go and end a psychopath, bring two body bags, one for you and one for them. These people do not go down willingly. And so I want to know, have you guys experienced even the tail end of what these people are capable of when you start exposing them? Okay, Ellen, would you like to go first there?
Personally, no. But of course, we've got many groups in the U.S. working to get public banks established. And we always come up against the big banks. And, you know, we get a lot of pushback. Politicians are obviously listening to somebody else. So, but I personally have never been threatened or felt threatened.
Okay. And what about maligned? Sidelined?
Maligned? Well, that's different.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes.
I remember, what was his name? Andrew Jackson, President of the United States, who famously killed the bank. That was his deathbed successes. And I recall that, and I think this is a general principle when you're fighting for the right thing, although your enemies come for you, chance, it seems, or fate seems to help you out as well. For example, Andrew Jackson being against the private banks, they have sent an assassin with two pistols, and both of those pistols misfired. Like a one in a million type chance. And I think the complexity of banking and the difficulty of implementing the solution, because you know how people are tech phobic and they don't think of themselves as techno learning? They look at this mass of things about interest and liquidity and so on and so forth. It's just this massive complex weaver thing that's just not worth talking about. And what if there's actually a rubber meets the road solution for these people? How can we get this idea across that this stuff is actually relatively simple? Scumbags creating something out of nothing and enslaving you with it.
Well, and the whole idea that we too could do that. I mean, we could own the banks. Well, what is currency? What is money really? It's a receipt for goods and services. So if the government issues it, that was what was it 1691, I think, the first American, that was actually the governor of the colony of New York, was dealing with a small border war, and he didn't have any money to pay his soldiers. So he got the bright idea of just printing little receipts acknowledging service, that, you know, that they were entitled to these receipts, and then the receipts traded in the community as money, and that was the beginning of the paper money of the American colonists. So anyway, it seems to me, if you're talking about doing something starting at the local level, that does seem to be where you can approach your local politicians, you can actually get to know them, you can get things done. And in the U.S., states under the Constitution cannot issue their own currencies, but cities can. So you could have like a local city community currency that was issued through a city public bank, let's say, that was backed by goods and services. Again, it would be a matter of issuing this currency in return for goods and services delivered. Originally, there were two types of backing of dollar bills in the 19th century in the U.S. One was by gold, but there were also local banks that backed their currencies with what was called real bills. And these were not something that you could leverage, that you could make 10 of instead of one. I mean, a real bill was good for a certain amount of goods or services, and that was it. So there was one bill for one shipment of goods, and whoever had the bill got the goods. And you could do that now. And there are movements to do that sort of thing, like a community currency that's backed by a future payment. It's basically a future promise to pay.
We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, with Alan Brown, Simon Thorpe, and Colin Maxwell talking about the public banking final solution at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Back in just a moment.
To my feet, I was a sacrificial lamb, all part of the past.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the fastest hour in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. It's a listener-supported broadcast, been going for nearly 15 years now, ladies and gentlemen. So I'm not going anywhere. I'm not some Johnny come lately. There is experience and there is knowledge to be had from listening to this show for a long period of time. You will listen to people that you've never heard of who are talking about things you never thought you were interested in, and it helps to give you a massive overlay, a great perspective by which to see more clear. We stand on the shoulders of giants so that we might see farther. My very special guests, Alan, Simon, and Colin, welcome back. We were talking about the issuance of local municipal currencies as a first step in the taking back of the public banking sector. And of course, there is legislation in the United States that Alan alluded to that is basically capable of doing such a thing as perhaps a city ordinance, if I may be so crass as to call it that, and then do similar things work elsewhere? And has anybody actually managed to implement this in a municipality? And specifically, what is the actual process? I mean, do we need a press, and we need a some kind of public coffer or something of that nature? Is there anything actually digital involved in the issuance of the public currency in this manner?
It is actually the digital cryptocurrencies that make all this possible. I mean, make something new possible that we never could do before, which is you could have community currencies all around the world that can trade with each other through cryptocurrency. Simon might know more about that. That sounds like what you've gotten into lately, right? You know.
So maybe I could comment that. But I think there are lots of possibilities of moving forward with alternatives. The real problem is that they don't get discussed. We are given the system which exists, the one that is costing $13 trillion in interest payments, and it's just stupid. But anybody who tries to suggest any alternative sort of basically doesn't get any bandwidth. And one of the options that I'm interested in, I'm not a big blockchain fan. I think that's just it proves that you can get out of the standard banking transaction system. But one other possibility which could be done everywhere is to use what I call an IOU based network. So basically, you don't actually need money. If two people want to do a transaction, and I give you a 10 kilograms of apples, and you send me an IOU in return, then that's actually a viable transaction. You can make that IOU in anything you like, in New Zealand dollars, in US dollars, in euros or whatever. But you don't actually need the money to do it. So you could have literally a system where I could run it from here. I could just have a sort of create a big sort of Excel sheet with for everybody on the planet, a sort of a login. And those people could send IOUs around. They don't actually need any money to use at all. It would be a public log of who owes what to who. And the great thing is that when you get, you know, if I owed Ellen, you know, $100, and Ellen owes Colin $100, and Colin owes Vinny $100, and Vinny owes me $100, that all cancels out. And so you could have the software just continuously looking for loops. You'd have 8 billion people in this thing, and it would be looking for loops in this system. And every time you find a loop, you just remove the smallest value in that loop everywhere. That system could replace all conventional debt-based money with interest. And it could be done in any local community. You could just set it up. It literally would require, you know, just a computer connected to the internet. But if you wanted to do it on the worldwide basis, you could. It would require, you know, organizing this across countries. So that's one of the ideas which could work. There's no reason why it wouldn't work, except that nobody talks about it. I'm glad you like it, Ellen.
Well, I'm wondering if you've written it up, because I didn't totally follow it, but it does sound promising.
Okay, so I've given a few sort of YouTube talks about this, so probably the latest one is one called AI, Technological Unemployment and UBI, where I actually go into explaining this. It's one of the things. The other things that work very well, by the way, are financial transaction taxes, and that's something that Colin and I were talking about last week, because there was a move in New Zealand to introduce a financial transaction tax, which if you applied, I mean, there are another sort of thing that you discover when you look into the details. There's something like quadrillion dollars of transactions every year, and those are just the visible ones. If you tax that at 0.1%, you could effectively get rid of all the other taxes, because it just will generate huge amounts of money that you could use to pay for UBI, or, you know, let's do things like solving climate change or things like this. The things that we really need to do could be done. I mean, would I object to paying 0.1% on everything, every transaction I make? No. It'd be a lot less than paying sales taxes and things like this. But because, you know, there's $6 trillion in foreign exchange every day, then that would sort of take off money from the financial monster, and it could be put into people's pockets. That's another pretty straightforward thing that nobody has talked about, except in New Zealand. So I was very pleased to hear that this was actually on the program of this political party that Colin could tell us about, which only got 1% of the vote, unfortunately. But that's an incredibly sensible thing to do, much better than taxing income or profits and things like this. You could just get rid of most taxes and use a financial transaction tax, very low level. So
It would also be a way, I mean, we try to figure out how are we going to tax the rich. Clearly there are multi-billionaires out there, and they've got control of government, and they're not going to tax themselves. But if you did even just a tiny, like you say, 0.1% or something of a tax, you're going to get rid of all that fluff that is all the speculative money at the top. So like high frequency program trading, that kind of thing, plus a lot of derivatives. I mean, if you did it, the problem is I'm sure they've probably done computer models or something, and the problem is you'd probably crash the system, because there's so many derivatives out there, and if you take down the derivatives all at once, etc. I don't know, but maybe we could creep up into it somehow.
The fact is that the financial sector actually charges for doing transactions, not very much, you know, sort of 0.1%. So you'd only be doubling what they already charge themselves. But the difference is that rather than using this as a way for the banking system to make a profit, you could use that money to generate money for the rest of us, you know, to provide healthcare and, you know, whatever you want to do. I mean, it's just a very easy way to do things and totally painless, because there's no tax returns to fill in. I mean, everybody hates taxes. I'm sure the people listening to this program probably hate taxes, but would they object to paying 0.1% of everything they, all transactions they make, given that the total volume of transactions is so absolutely phenomenal? But it's not done by individuals. That's done by computers doing high-frequency trading. every millisecond they're changing, you know, $1 million into $1 million into euros and then back again, you know, just because you can take a little bit of money on that. So that would be a very easy thing to do. But of course, nobody talks about that because it would reduce the profits of the banking sector, and those profits are what they use to buy politicians, economists, and journalists. So we need people like you, Vinnie, by the way, to, you know, independent voices to get the message across. But it's really hard work because, you know, the mainstream media is not interested.
My hope is that when we hit a major crisis, that's when politicians seem to be interested in new ideas. For instance, in the 1930s, I mean, they did the most remarkable things that you would never pull off right now. Congress agreed to things. They agreed to like anything that looked like it might work, and it did work. So if arguably we're probably coming into a major banking crisis, and it seems to me they might actually consider some of these revolutionary ideas. The one example we have, we don't have any examples of, well, anyway, the one example we have is the Bank of North Dakota in North Dakota of a public, local public bank, and it's worked brilliantly, and it's worked brilliantly for decades. It's running circles around every other state in many measures. So basically what they do is all the state's revenues are deposited in the bank by law in the Bank of North Dakota. It was founded in 1919, so it's over 100 years old. And then that money is leveraged like all banks do. You know, they make loans, they partner with local banks, and the local banks are sort of the front office of the system. I mean, it's all a partnership system. The local banks all endorse the Bank of North Dakota, whereas when we try to bring public banking bills, we always get pushback from the private bankers. But in North Dakota, they love each other. It all works well. And the Bank of North Dakota steps in. And I mean, they only step in when the local bank asks for help. They step in and help with liquidity, help with capitalization, help with regulation, that type of thing. So they used to make student loans, but they're cutting back on that. So they don't make many loans that they actually initiate themselves. They're a partnership with the local banks, and that works well. So that's the model we're trying to duplicate. But one problem we have in the U.S. is that the Federal Reserve doesn't want to give a master account to any bank that doesn't have FDIC insurance, and that's deposit insurance. And the FDIC doesn't want to give insurance for public banks because they said we were set up to insure private banks. So we haven't figured it out. I mean, they haven't actually said that in writing, so arguably we can get past that. But we've heard that through the grapevine. The Bank of America Samoa is a publicly owned bank, and they did get a master account, but they've been told by the FDIC that they're going to have to privatize if they want to keep their FDIC insurance. So that's what we're up against.
Why we're talking about this in terms of like what I can do, like as a broadcaster and things of that nature. This has come off the discussion that Colin and I had with John Ansell, and John Ansell Durandley has won numerous radio and TV advertising awards and things of that nature. And one time he was accused by his political cohorts of dumbing things down, to which he replied, "Why do you always want to complicate up?" That's the essence that we're trying to get through here, is that the reason why people don't understand the system and what's happening there is because it is complex and there's too many words. Like if it's two words on a billboard that you're driving past at 100 miles an hour and you can read it and understand it, people will be able to get behind it en masse. So it's simply a crafting tool. We've got the engineers and the scientists and things of that nature that create the product, but then they've got to have somebody that goes out there and sells the product. So selling this product. Selling the public banking system to the public must be, of course, the next logical phase in this channel. How to make it relatable, how to make it simple, how to make it easy to understand. And we saw with that conversation, didn't we, Colin, that the 1% financial transaction tax, or even a 0.1%, as Simon was saying there before, is something that could work. And the idea itself is potentially simple enough so that it could become so simplified that people would be able to get it. Now, you talked about pushback and all of these paid off media people and so on and so forth. How exactly do we subvert that process when they control what people's eyes and ears are exposed to?
People seem to be more and more open to alternative media, though. So that's you.
All right. This is my problem. All right. That's the show, ladies and gentlemen. I've figured out the answer to the question. What's the solution to all of this? It's me. And Colin, I'd like you to talk about New Zealand Loyal for a second, because, of course, attaching these policies to a political vehicle, I'm not 100% sure whether or not it's been done before or how successful it's actually been. So how did you really get this kind of policy in there?
Good question. Basically, it's sort of been covered before, and Ellen actually covered it in her book about the old social credit model in New Zealand. Of course, social credit's now a dirty word. You can't really name a party that. But at one stage, way back in my local electorate, back in the 60s, they actually won a seat here, and they had representation in Parliament. So that was based on the old C.H. Douglas model. That was a Scottish engineer. Once again, he wasn't an economist, he was an engineer, but he seemed to run rings around all the other economists, that most of them that I've heard of. And that was basically this social credit system, the old definition. So none of this is new, and that movement lasted in New Zealand till the 80s, and it actually got about 20% or just over 20% of the popular vote. But it's the same old story with attrition and what you guys are talking about, how these systems get hammered to death. They gradually lost their support, and I think in 2020 they were languishing down at about 0.01% of support. And since then they've deregistered. So basically that movement's died in New Zealand. But It was a system that was just as viable then as it was today, but the main hurdle seems to be, or the default from the average New Zealander is, oh, it's so simple, it couldn't possibly work. And if it was that simple, it would be done before, and they just switch off. So that's the difficulty. New Zealand Loyal, because that was their main, they had a really incredibly courageous economic policy, and that the cornerstone of that was the financial transaction tax. So that sort of started the conversation again, but in conjunction with public banking, or Alan calls it public banking solution, which I think is the best name. Other people call it public banking utility. So the two things are incredibly powerful when you use them together. So a country like New Zealand, within 2 years of them implementing both those things, that we could be rolling in money. We could be an economic miracle, a model for the world. But most New Zealanders don't want to know about it. And as Vinny said, that party in New Zealand world only got 1.15% of the popular vote. But I didn't think it was an election. I thought it was a New Zealand IQ test, and we failed it miserably. So that's my...
To put this into context, however, this is a party that got 1.15 1.15% of the vote, and they got registered as a party during the election campaign, all right? As in, they had about maybe a month or two or three max to go out there and campaign, and they still pulled that. There are registered parties like the Legalized Cannabis Party here has been going since 1996, I believe, and they regularly pull about 0.3% without terribly much effort. And this massive kind of push right at the last minute to reach over 1% is actually incredibly encouraging. Let's also think about the context here, whereby there were a number of other freedom parties. I believe there was a total of 8 running in that election. So in terms of the freedom vote metric, it actually tripled over the between election cycles towards freedom-oriented parties rather than other ones. So it could be the beginning of something bigger. Simon, go right ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to say to people in New Zealand, you are in a wonderful place for trying radical things. You've got your own economy. It's pretty well isolated from other places. In Europe, it's totally impossible. You know, France can't do anything. We've got the Lisbon Treaty, which stops governments borrowing from their own, from central banks. There are all sorts of things which basically make it impossible to change the system. New Zealand is perhaps the place on the planet where you could do something really original. And I think the thing to do possibly before anything else is to have a really open debate where all the different options are listed. And you get the bankers coming in and saying, why is it sensible that you create the money supply as interest-bearing debt? Why is that better than the government creating the money as interest-bearing debt, which is used to pay tax to avoid paying taxes or whatever? There are lots and lots of different things you could do. Financial transaction taxes is one of them, an IOU net type thing, and so on. So I would say that would be my recommendation. Have a wide-ranging thing. There are lots of possible solutions, but they never get talked about. And I'm going to give Ella a plug. Her book on public banking has a chapter on New Zealand, because New Zealand, along with other Commonwealth countries, had a great period where the government had there was a public banking system. Read that chapter, and you will realise just what you lost when you let the international banking conglomerate come in and saying, oh, no, it's much better to let us lend you the money and charge interest for you. Of course it is for them. It's not good for people in New Zealand. So that's, I think, and New Zealand, as I say, could be the best place to do this, because you have a relatively isolated system which is not too connected with everything else, and you could do it on your own. Go for it.
Well, that being said, of course, New Zealand is a center for world money laundering, whereby the Panama paper leaks, I believe, mentioned New Zealand 66,000 times as a center for money laundering worldwide. So I'm pretty sure that the bankers have relatively a strong hold here, because New Zealand, as I refer to it, is basically the Cayman Islands of the South Pacific. These mountains we have to climb, the hurdles we have to overcome, and New Zealanders unfortunately have an average IQ of 95. So this is due to world records, and to put that into perspective for people, the average IQ of people in North Korea, communist North Korea, is 110. Okay, those kids can take apart and reassemble a rifle blindfolded. You know what New Zealand kids can do? They can watch TikTok. Okay, we're in trouble here, folks.
Yes, but you can change your economic system. I don't think people in North Korea can do it very easily.
You know, you're probably right there. You know, we can't all be winners, they say. So, in terms of... Oh, go ahead, Ellen.
It's actually the shadow banking system that's even worse than the conventional banking system, because in the shadow banking system, you can leverage it 30 to 1 or 40 to 1. I mean, that's what they did in the Great Recession. Lehman Brothers, I think, was leveraging it 30 to 1. So, and they're not actually banks. They're just, they're using collateral as the alternative to FDIC insurance. I guess you're done. Okay, bye.
Guys, it's been a pleasure, an honor, and I will never forget this show until I do the next one. Thank you guys so much for for being with me today. We're just a bunch of whinging, whining bastards and girls, aren't we? Aren't we tonight?
And Poms.
Yes, we'll leave the limeys to the lime green cash dispensing ATMs in your local vicinity. In the meantime, ladies and gentlemen, you need to at least use cash, because once they have a full digital currency, they can just turn your bank accounts off, and then we're all done. With that cheery note, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to have a WikiLeak, and we'll see you again.